Welcome to our podcast series, Talking with Traders, hosted by expert trader Garth McKenzie in London, from where he's interviewing various guests on the topic of trading.
Welcome to Season 2 of the Talking with Traders podcast series with me, Garth McKenzie. In this season, I'll be interviewing various successful traders and investors in my network and asking them pertinent questions about their career in the financial markets. I'll also be discussing how they've dealt with the recent surge in market volatility following the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic and how they are viewing the future as we all adjust to a new way of working. We'll also be talking about market themes that are likely to gain traction in a post-COVID-19 world. Joining me for today's podcast is Sy Jacobs. Sy is the co-founder of 361 Asset Management. The firm has been operational in South Africa for the last 15 years. They run unit trust funds and hedge funds and manage several billion rands of assets under management. Their track record is phenomenal. They have great market outperformance over the years, and everything that 361 does screams professionalism. I first met Sy back in 2006 when I was a broker at BOE Stockbrokers. We used to house and broker some of their trades in the early days of 361 Asset Management. Sy, thanks very much for joining me on today's podcast.
Absolutely, and thanks, Garth, for the time. It's been a long time since we chatted. Early days at Nedbank, and remember when you first started in the market, and sure, done well since then. Always brought a lot of energy to the market, which I think is a great thing.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that, and likewise to yourself. So if we go back to the beginning, you know, what got you into the markets in the beginning and got you into this career from the start?
Well, as a teenager at school, I actually had a very good friend whose father was quite shrewd and invested in the market for many years, a chartered accountant. And myself and my good friend started investing when we were about 16. We didn't have much money. In fact, I didn't come from any money, so I think we had a couple of thousand rand. But we started following things and getting some advice from his father. And as time went on, we managed to secure actually an overdraft guaranteed by his father. But unfortunately, after the trick, I went away as an exchange student for a year, and that year happened to be 1987. And we got caught up in the October crash, lost our money. In fact, we landed up with a net negative balance, given the fact that our knowledge on markets was not good at the time. And his father was rather strict, and we went into a loan agreement for a few years and had to pay all the money back with interest. And I think that was a very interesting lesson. And it didn't deter me from investments, but it made me rather cautious. And I think that's been my first and most valuable lesson in markets. And from then, I just took a path, became a CA, went straight into markets after my articles, and have been in the markets ever since.
That's fascinating. So, but like many of the people I've interviewed on this podcast series, you also had a bit of a baptism by fire, starting out not so well. I mean, I count myself the same in that respect. My first couple of years weren't very good either, and also lost some money along the way. But obviously, you've really evolved, and your career's developed substantially, and you've now head up 361, hedge fund manager, unit trust fund manager, and everything that you do, you know, just screams out professionalism. Certainly over the years that I dealt with you when I was a broker at BOE, we did a couple of your trades there, and everything that I see of you in the publicity and, you know, everything around 361 just smacks of professionalism, and kudos to you for that. But you mentioned that you learned some valuable lessons early on in life about risk and what have you. So taking it forward now, what is your primary strategy nowadays in terms of how you invest or trade the market?
Yeah, so first of all, I'm not a great trader. So let's understand there's a big, very big difference between trading and investing. And in the short term, I've honestly probably one of the worst traders you'll find. So very difficult for me to make short-term profits unless something is really glaringly obvious and offers value or is overvalued or there could be a potential catalyst. So I've always learned, and I've learned over the years, that, you know, long-term investing in great businesses, you know, that have good moats, that have technology associated with them, that can continually innovate have ultimately become the best investments. Those in South Africa, unfortunately, of late and in the last number of years, are very limited. So I haven't been able to find, you know, particularly South African businesses listed on the South African market that exhibit those characteristics. But overall, you know, sticking to good quality businesses, particularly international businesses, you know, have really stood us and myself, you know, a great, you know, in a great way. And I think that overall, avoiding the poor quality, badly run, you know, businesses in industries that are antiquated, that, you know, maybe don't have the future, is, you know, what we've avoided. And obviously the hedge fund, we've taken advantage of both. But overall, it's not a very complicated investment objective. It's just to be in businesses that continually grow, deliver good cash flows, have great management teams that are aligned along the same lines as us as shareholders, and over time, that, you know, that's delivered great returns.
Yeah, so it talks to consistency. And with that, you know, as you've mentioned, you look at businesses that are that have a future ahead of them, and you're not that keen on old economy type of stuff. Obviously, we're living through an extremely tumultuous time in the world now. We're living through history with COVID-19 and what have you, and everything's changing. The way we work is changing. All of us are having to suddenly become a bit more innovative in terms of how we can continue to do our business. So with that in mind, I mean, is there anything, or are there any specific themes that you're picking up on or that you're following on in terms of investment themes looking into the future that perhaps were not there just a couple of months ago?
Well, I think we've seen an acceleration of the trends that were happening. There's no doubt in my mind that unfortunately, and you now living abroad, but unfortunately, South Africa is deteriorating, you know, at a significant pace. And that pace now, in my view, has accelerated. And that would, you know, tend us to believe that South African specific investments in local industries are going to be very tough. And maybe, you know, thankfully we're in the hedge fund game, so we could effectively utilize those investments to potentially make money and maybe find the relatively better ones versus the relatively worse ones. So still there's, you know, an arbitrage opportunity, even though things are declining. But I think this COVID pandemic has made us, you know, wake up quickly and realize that, you know, a lot of the technology businesses in biotech, in health tech, in, you know, in various types of technology, and businesses that have just embraced technology, you know, and have metamorphosized and effectively converted their business models to utilize technology are going to be the winners in the future. And it's difficult in this pandemic to see South African businesses, or the majority of them, actually doing that. But it is very easy to recognize, I think, many of the global leaders in that space. And so that's where we've been directing as much as of investment as possible, you know, away from this domestic market.
Yeah, okay. And in terms of risk, obviously we've been through an extremely volatile time in the market now in the first half of 2020. And you're in the hedge fund space, as you've obviously mentioned, longs and shorts. But risk is a big thing. And when you got the market swinging as wildly as it has done over the last few months, I mean, we saw the fastest crash, fastest decline on the S&P 500 ever, followed by the fastest rally almost ever on the S&P 500 within a very short space of time. How do you approach that in terms of risk management so that you don't incur these enormously wild swings on your portfolios? And have you had to change your approach towards risk at all, given the recent excessive volatility?
Yeah, so that question is very general, and I suppose it depends really on which mandate specifically you're referring to. So, for example, in the hedge fund space, you know, we're always very, very prone to protecting the portfolio because risk is probably at the forefront of that type of investment. The benchmark is cash. So effectively, you're not meant to take effectively a lot of market risk in that kind of portfolio. So leading into a COVID position, we had proper protection in the way of put spreads, normal put protection, a very low net exposure to markets, shorts balancing out the longs. So in the tumultuous time, as you so called it, the fund fully protected capital on the way down, and we got a small amount of the upside on the way up, so that the fund continued to basically outperform its benchmark of cash per annum, which it's done significantly, you know, probably two or three times cash over the life of the fund per annum. But it effectively is run very much around the risk associated with the beta of the market and protecting that beta from the portfolio. If you look in other portfolios of ours, and we run a lot of unit trusts, as you mentioned, general equity unit trusts, SA equity unit trusts, flexible funds, balanced funds, it all would depend really on the benchmark of that particular fund. If it's a pure equity benchmark, then the risk for us is all about our equities just really outperforming the equities of the market. So obviously we're prepared to go down. If the market falls 30%, we know we're going to take a rather large drawdown. In this case, we managed to take probably 15% less than the market on the way down. And as a result, on a year-to-date basis, are about 15% ahead of the market. And, you know, that for us is an absolute result, because that's what the client is setting you in that type of portfolio, a benchmark to beat the market. So risk gets really applied differently across different types of portfolios. But overall, it has always been key to us relative to the benchmark to ensure that we understand our intrinsic risks versus the appropriate benchmarks.
Okay. Yeah. Fantastic. Now, your saying, or the byline of your firm, 361, it's going the extra degree. And everything you've talked about there is essentially that, just going that extra little bit further to try and achieve that extra couple of percent over the market, and that ultimately compounds over time. And if you do that year in and year out, you'll actually achieve phenomenal results over the long period of time. I've recently read a book, or listened to the audio book by James Clear, called Atomic Habits. And in that, he refers to just doing everything 1% better. And if you can consistently do everything just that 1% better, then ultimately the long-term result becomes significantly better. I must say, I had a first-hand experience with that when you and I dealt in early days. And I think now this was right in the beginning when you were when you had just started 361. It was probably 2006 or maybe 2007. I was a broker, and some of the trades that you did through our desk. And I remember one particular incident. We all have these incidents in our memories which some of us never forget. And this particular time, I don't even know whether you'll remember this, Si, but I'll remind you of it anyway. There was quite a lot of new listings coming to the market in the preference share space, and particularly in the banking area of the market. And APSA listed some preference shares, and they came to market, and I think that they came to market at about 75% of prime. And you'd placed an order with us to participate in the IPO of those preference shares, but you were specific on your level. And I think you had said you wanted them at 73% of prime, no more. And in any case, our dealer, who then went ahead and put our orders into the auction for this new listing, came back and we got the stock at 75%, and I took it to you and you said, sorry, I didn't want it at 75%. I wanted it at 73%. I'm not taking the stock. And it was a small difference, but in any case, we had to wear the misdeal. And it was also a very good learning experience for me as well. And don't worry, I still got my bonus that year, so I'm not complaining. But the reason I bring this up and why I want to raise this is the question is that, you know, everything you do, like I said, it smacks of professionalism and just everything is very, very, very professional. But we also know that this game isn't always plain sailing. It's not always calm seas. And even though you strive to try and get that extra 1% and do that extra little thing just that little bit better, as I experienced with that trade that I referenced there, it's not always plain sailing. So over the years, you know, I'm sure you've had ups and downs. And have you got any particular experiences that you can tell us about where things were tough and you had to, you know, dig deep to try and keep motivated and keep going in this business?
Yeah, so I think for us, we've had a few of those times. Obviously, in 15 years, you know, markets don't always respond to the way you're thinking. I think the one particular time I can remember was probably January of 08. It was just before the global financial crisis. But, you know, we'd gone on holiday at the end of 2007. We had a phenomenal year. Funds were up 30% pluses. Everything was good, but we had quite significant net exposure. And January 2008, Eskom, out of nowhere, with no warning, basically ran into trouble, and lights switched off and markets corrected. And it was an interesting time for us because we got a fright and maybe we overreacted and we tried to protect the portfolios. In the meantime, we had a V-shaped recovery like we've had now in the pandemic in the month of January of 08. And we participated on the down, but never participated on the up. And as a result, we had quite a big knock, 10% of our funds, where we, you know, went down 10% in a single month. We did actually make that back over the next couple of months, so it ended up being not that serious, but I think it was a really big lesson for us. And as a result, specifically in the hedge funds, some investors got spooked. How can a hedge fund lose 10% in such a short period of time? And I think we learned many lessons from that. And a lot of the way we manage the hedge fund over the years has progressed in a very scientific and calculated way since then. And, you know, I doubt our biggest loss since then has been probably, a couple of percent in any given month. And we really pride ourselves on the fact that, you know, all the months since then, I think, you know, if you take, I think it's something like 36 different months since that period, the market's been down 3 to 4% plus in those months. The hedge fund has overall lost zero in those very negative months.
You're listening to Talking with Traders, a podcast series brought to you by IG, a world-leading online trading and investment provider. If you haven't checked out the IG online trading platform, please do so and visit IG.com. Also, make sure you subscribe to the podcast series on your favorite podcast app or website by clicking on the subscribe button, and you'll be notified weekly as we release new episodes.
So, we've had those experiences. I can think of a specific stock experience as well in 2008. Centula, for example. Management. We often don't get caught up in believing management. As you know, we're very skeptical. But in that particular year, we did believe that Centula was real, and there were no real frauds happening, and nothing was misrepresented. But we got caught by that investment as well in that year, and it cost our funds around 2%. In 2008. So I remember those hard ones where something gets wiped out and you effectively were long the position. Thankfully, I think post that era, pretty much all the wipeouts that have happened in the markets, the Steinhoffs, various property groups that have collapsed and weren't doing things according to the book, as far as we're concerned, you know, as well as the Tongaats and various other misrepresented opportunities, we've luckily been on pretty much the right side of all of those, and luckily haven't taken any big knocks on any of those opportunities. So overall, a couple of bad stories, maybe one bad month, but overall it's been very good, and we've learned from a few lessons.
Okay, super. Now, you referenced a couple of the good ones there where you were on the right side of frauds and things like that. And obviously, yes, I know you were on the right side of Steinhoff. You guys were short in Steinhoff. And also another one that that you got a good lot of good press for was being short in African Bank when that stock collapsed to zero as well. And obviously, those are brilliant from a press and a marketing point of view to have been on the right side of those, but I know that they would have been a pretty small percentage of your fund overall. Nevertheless, it worked out well for you. But in that context, have you got any specific best trades or best investments that stand out for you over the years?
On the long side, there's only one investment for us that stood out both for the funds and for me personally has been Naspers. If I go back to the eras even before 2008, when Koos Bekker was in charge as CEO, and he was very approachable and the company wasn't that sought after as it is today, we used to meet actually on a six-monthly basis in these small little offices at the BJM offices. And I used to listen to this absolutely insightful genius of a man who would explain how the world was going to evolve from a technology point of view. And I bought into his view and his insight and his strategy and everything about the way he was positioning this business. And I think, you know, from those days to today, that's been our largest investment. Yes, it's become obviously the largest in the market over the past decade, but it wasn't in the earlier years. And it was, as a result, I think we've been very lucky. I've been lucky. In fact, the South African market has been lucky that something like this existed here, because without that, there wouldn't have been much excitement, specifically in the last few years and maybe even during this COVID pandemic, you know, that's offered people an opportunity, a Rand hedge technology opportunity of international scale. So that's definitely, on an investment side, been by far, by just country miles, the single best investment. And obviously that's on the unit trust, the long side, the hedge fund. On the short side, yes, as you said, these are never really large opportunities. African Bank was a big one. You know, the Resilient Group turned out to be a very good one as well. There's been various, you know, short opportunities over the years in many businesses. So I think as a theme in the last couple of years, the overall industrial, retail, financial businesses that are listed here in South Africa that are domestically, inwardly focused, and I'd add to that all the property counters, have been really phenomenal opportunities on the short side, and in aggregate they've done very well for the funds.
Yeah, no, for sure. But I think what one thing we must just point out to anybody listening to this interview is that when you're short, the best you can hope to do is to make 100% on your short, obviously unless you're geared. But the point is that the worst that can happen, or the best that can happen, is the price goes to naught and you make 100% on your short. Whereas when you're long, you can make many hundreds of percent, as in the case of Naspers for you since those early days.
Yeah, I mean, we've looked at Naspers a few times, and we have some clients we bought Naspers for in the early days that are up a few thousand percent. So, I mean, that's obviously, compared to shorts, it would get nowhere near that. We have some, you know, shares that cost 60 Rand, and obviously the combined value now between Naspers, Prosus, MultiChoice, and one or two other small things have unbundled over the years, you know, it's close to 5,000. So, you know, 60 bucks to 5,000 bucks is not a bad return.
No, certainly not a bad return at all. Just on that, I mean, obviously that does then become an outsized position in a portfolio when you see such an incredible outperformance. Do you look to sort of reweight that position? Because, I mean, in reweighting a Naspers over the years actually would have been detrimental to one's performance if you were kept it to a limited portion of a portfolio.
Yeah, unfortunately, we did, I mean, continually sell off portions, you know, because it is always got that slight risk attached to you. Who knows, you know, whether there could have been a change in Chinese regulation or a competitor could have, you know, eaten their market share, or something could have happened in the specific technologies. It's very difficult to have, you know, by now you would have had 80 or 90% of your portfolio in one stock. So we had continually reduced the portfolio, the stake in pretty much all our portfolios, but remain very outsized. I mean, even today, if you look at our SA equity long-only portfolio between Prosus and Naspers, we have 23% of our funds in those two combined, which is effectively the same business. And it's been an, you know, overweight position in many, not always, but in many of the years that have gone by. Obviously, Tencent has also had its ups and downs over time. And hopefully during those downs, we haven't been too overweight. And that has also, you know, given us some cushion.
Mm. Okay, fantastic. Now, just on a more general note, you know, Si, if a youngster came to you and said, I'm interested in getting involved in the market, I want to become a hedge fund manager one day, or a unit trust fund manager, and this is the career that I want to follow, what two or three pieces of advice would you give to that youngster?
Well, I think the game here as well is evolving. So I think today, you know, had I started off in today's era, and let's say I had the same interest I had 30-something years ago in the markets, I'm not quite sure that the path I would have taken today would be the same as the path I took then. And I think that because the way we're trading, and you'll know this very much, Garth, is, you know, it's evolving. Data science is becoming a lot more important. You know, AI has picked up dramatically. The biggest funds today have an enormous advantage over funds like ourselves. Luckily, it's not a major thing in South Africa yet. But in global markets, you need almost data scientists that are looking at a, you know, very quantitative way of assessing data and information and applying a lot of that together with fundamentals. So I think to have your, you know, to be a junior guy now who really comes in with no experience, you know, it's difficult to use, let's say, old style techniques of evaluating companies from a fundamental point of view and, you know, really getting traction in this asset management game in the years to go forward. And would suggest, you know, you rather study all these various applied mathematics and data and try and, you know, almost conquer the entry into asset management in a different way, a new, more exciting way. And I think, you know, there are various studies. We had an actuary who worked for us who went and pursued that avenue in the UK and is now, you know, potentially, you know, going to run funds along those lines. And I think there's a great need for that type of a person compared to, let's call it, our old style techniques that we use.
Okay. And are there any books that you think are must reads that any aspirant investor should have on their bookshelf?
Well, you know, you asked me this actually yesterday, and I thought, are there any books that you would read? And I think I thought about it from a trading point of view, and I just remembered old books that I read. The one was Reminiscence of a Stockbroker, which I'm sure you've read it.
Yep.
And that, if you're a trader, that was a very interesting book. Not that I'm, as I mentioned, a great trader. I thought for me the most pertinent book I ever read, actually, which gave you perspective on what can happen even if you write in the hedge fund game, was Red Notice, about the Russian hedge fund manager. And I think that wasn't really about the skill set, but more about what you're up against in various economies. And I'm not saying South Africa is necessarily the same as Russia, but some very interesting lessons to be learned when you try to take on the corporate world in a particular economy, specifically an emerging economy, where potentially your regulation and law is not as strong as let's say in the US. And it's things to just be cautious of, that you may be right, you may be 100% right, but the result in the end may not be what you get and hope for, because the truth is that, you know, there are many bad people in many of these economies, and a lot of those bad people get to various institutional heights and regulation and regulators and connections in government and strong institutions. And I think that that book gives you a great perspective of, you know, caution you need to take in dealing in markets where maybe the regime, you know, is not a full free market economy.
Thanks. I'm going to look that one up, because I must say, after doing all of these interviews with various different traders and investors, many different books have come up, and I'm actually adding quite actively to my Audible library at the moment, adding lots of new books to read. So thank you very much for that one. That hasn't come up in any of the recommendations yet in any of the other interviews. We're nearing the end of our allotted time, Sai, so just one or two more questions. The one thing I've always wondered about is guys like yourself who bear such a huge responsibility. You know, you're looking after billions of rands of assets under management. It's an incredibly large responsibility. How do you balance out that, you know, there must be a lot of stress associated with that. How do you achieve balance in life, looking after that level of responsibility, that amount of money, and still managing to, you know, balance out a family life and all of the other things to live a balanced life? How do you manage that?
Yeah, so that's a very good question, and it's obviously not that easy. And I think many times to your family, specifically my children, it's frustrating because, you know, you can be on a holiday on a beach, but markets are still open and you've still got the responsibility of watching everything and keeping up to date with all news and company releases to ensure that you are correctly positioned. So it unfortunately does have very negative aspects that spill over, I think, into your personal life that are unavoidable. And specifically, if you want to remain good at the forefront of all information, you know, you can't just switch off your life and switch on your personal life at any time. So the two are intertwined. So it is a challenge. I think over the years, your families probably get used to it and understand that that's just the way it is. And they obviously see the upside of that if you do well. But I guess, you know, the lucky thing for us over the years is that, you know, we are more longer term investors, and it is quite unusual that you would need to make substantial shifts in our overall portfolio, like on a daily basis. It's more tweaks around certain elements. So, you know, the stress, hopefully on a, you know, in a quiet time between, you know, Christmas and New Year and other, you know, long weekends, etc., does alleviate, but it is a challenge, and it will always be a challenge. So that's why I think, especially hectic traders have a limited lifespan in them, you know. So I think for us, it's lasted a lot longer because we're a lot longer term focused. But yeah, it's a difficult one to balance.
Yeah, for sure. And last thing, I see you guys manage, run, and sponsor the 361 Mountain Bike Challenge, and I was reading about that on the internet before we started this interview. So 36.1 hours to complete the beast is what it says, and it's a 361 kilometer mountain bike challenge in and around the area around Oudtshoorn in the Karoo. Looks fantastic. I'm a mountain bike rider, but I've never done anything like that. Are you a cyclist yourself, Si, and do you participate in that event?
Yeah, so I've done the event a couple of times, but I've never done the full 361Ks. There is an option to do half. So it was actually my idea because I thought 180Ks on a mountain bike was enough in a single day. It's a very grueling event, but it's a phenomenal event. I mean, the landscape is phenomenal. At our peak, we had close to 1,000 people, I think of which 800 or 900 attempted the full 361 kilometers. It's a single stage, so, you know, you just ride until you're done. We have phenomenal checkpoints and food, and people go to sleep at various stages if they need to. But it really is something I would recommend if you're interested in endurance events, try. It's a very non-technical ride as well, so the chance of you doing any damage is close to zero. And it's really been a phenomenal ride, and I look forward to maybe one day, if I've got more time, you know, challenging myself to ride the full distance.
Yeah, fantastic. And that race happens in November. So are there still entries available?
There's still entries available. We actually had to move the event to November. It normally takes place in the end of March or April. And we moved it subsequently actually even to May. But this year we've had to move it to November and hope that it will take place by November.
Absolutely. Well, Si, it's really been interesting talking to you. Thanks so very, very much for giving me 45 minutes of your time today. It's been fascinating. All the best, and I look forward to catching up again.
All the best, Garth, and all the best in the markets, and I hope you're doing well in the UK. And thanks for the time as well.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us for today's episode of Talking with Traders, brought to you by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a leader in the field of online trading involved in this series. Please follow us on Facebook and engage with us there. And a reminder to make sure you subscribe to the series by clicking the subscribe button on your favorite app. Till next time.